You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons Ram.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Daniel checking something on his phone. What's going on, Daniel?
No, I'm looking at my database of all of the climbs that the Giro has ever been over.
That's great.
Wow.
Diligent. So diligent. Wow. Lionel Burney.
Hello,
well,
Richard.
Is opposite me. Hello, Lionel.
Opposite you in every sense, Richard.
Really?
No. No. We're very much teammates, aren't we, in the Grand Tours?
Only in the Grand Tours.
Goal-aligned teammates.
Very goal-aligned, Lionel, I think, generally. How are you both on this
great
sunny day in London, a few days before we leave for the Giro?
Great. Sort of slightly disorganised, a bit haphazard. Got a pack for a couple of stints at the Giro. Got to finalise my complicated travel plans for a brief.
Got to get your bag on the flight as well, haven't I, Lionel?
Can you book me some luggage, please, on the flight and check me in?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I've got a bit of a problem with the French Speed Golf Open that I'm supposed to be entering. So the bill is getting hefty. I might have to pull out due to financial reasons.
Really?
Yeah, it would involve...
Is this you launching a crowdfunding appeal on the podcast?
Well, it would involve hiring a car. The Mont Blanc Tunnel, I remember from the Giro about 3 or 4 years ago, the Mont Blanc Tunnel is very, very expensive, and I'd have to go do a return journey through the Mont Blanc Tunnel. That'd be over probably 100 euros.
What's the prize money, though?
100 euros to enter.
What's the prize money?
I think nothing. I think... just sporting immortality.
Wow. Yeah, because you were going to leave the Giro to play in the
Yeah,
speed
it could be
golf.
In jeopardy. Mm. Anyway.
Oh, well. Don't worry, listeners. While those two are distracted by other sporting events, I will be fully focused on the Giro for 3 weeks. Promise you. So this week's episode, we are previewing the Giro by answering some of your questions about the Giro. You've phoned in, left messages, left WhatsApp voice memos. We got there eventually, didn't we, Lionel?
Yep.
And we've got a load of questions. We'll not get through them all, I don't think. We've got a lot of questions. And we'll do this also on the rest days at the Giro. So if you don't get a question answered this time, do call in on either of the rest days. We'll crack on with that in a moment. Some really good questions. But before that, Lionel, could we have the news roundup? I should say we'll also be giving details of Kilometre Zero and our sponsor of Kilometre Zero in this episode.
Indeed, Richard. Well, with the Giro starting in Bologna on Saturday, a couple of big bits of news. One is that Egan Bernal, who was expected to lead Team Ineos, is out of the Giro. He crashed in training and has broken his collarbone. Looks very likely that he will ride the Tour de France instead. The world champion Alejandro Valverde, who was going to ride for Movistar after his difficulties in the two Ardennes classics, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, he is also out of the Giro. But one rider who looks like he's bang in form is Primoz Roglic, who won the Tour de Romandie in Switzerland overall ahead of Rui Costa and Geraint Thomas. He also won three stages, including the time trial and the toughest mountain stage, which was shortened because of bad weather. The other stages were won by Roglic's fellow Slovenian, Jan Tratnik, David Godu, the climber of Groupama FDJ, and Stefan Kung. Daniel was in Yorkshire for the Tour de Yorkshire. Chris Lawless won overall there ahead of Greg Van Avermaet. So Team Sky won their final race, the Tour of the Alps, and Team Ineos won their first race, the Tour de Yorkshire. They're kind of a hybrid brand in Romandie, certainly at least as far as the jersey was concerned. Anyway, Chris Lawless won overall. His teammate Eddie Dunbar was third. There were stage wins there for Jasper Asselman, Rick Zabel, and the young Danish rider Alexander Kamp, who Daniel...
The white horse of Kurga.
There we are. Fascinating.
I asked him whether he was a dark horse, and he said, no, I'm a white horse. And I subsequently established he's from a place called Kurga.
And he also said he was the best rider in the field, or the greatest climber of all time, something like that, didn't he, Daniel?
Yeah, he came out like Muhammad Ali on the final morning. It was brilliant. Brilliant. Big fan.
Well, the women's race was an all-Dutch affair.
He climbed like Muhammad Ali as well.
Oh, that...
Yeah. Climbed all right. I'm sure Muhammad Ali could climb all right as well.
The women's race was an all-Dutch affair. Lorena Wiebes won the opening stage and Marianne Vos won a three-up sprint to take stage two and the overall honours. Meanwhile, in Asturias, at the Vuelta a Asturias, Richard Carapaz of Movistar won a stage and the overall there. Remember, he was fourth overall in last year's Giro. He'll be a key man for Movistar's Mikel Landa at the Giro, which starts, as I say, on Saturday. Our coverage kicks off on Saturday night. Daily episodes after every stage. Press conference episodes on the rest day. Kilometre Zero on Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings. And we're all set.
Before we move on, just a couple of points about Tour de Yorkshire. We have discussed the women's race at length in this month's Cycling Podcast Femina, which is coming out this week as well. We've also got an interview in there with Lizzie Dagnan and a few others too. I also spoke to James Shaw at the Tour de Yorkshire. We might hear that at some point. Young rider who was discarded by Lotto Soudal after 2 years, still only 22 years old, rode exceptionally well, finished fifth. The only rider who really followed Chris Froome when he attacked on Sunday's stage for a brief moment anyway. Interesting story to follow, I think. He's stepped down to continental level. Will he get back into the World Tour? Who knows?
Richard, you said he had considered retraining as a train driver when his professional contract expired.
Yeah, an interesting guy. We spoke to him quite a bit on the podcast. You met him a couple of years ago, just before he began with Lotto Soudal. So we will hear that interview at some point in the future.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons RAM.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our headline sponsor, supporting us once again at the Giro d'Italia this year. Very grateful to them for their support. I mentioned last week you can read the Rafa roadmap on velonews.com and at rafa.cc, full of ideas about how professional cycling is organised in the future and analysis of some of the issues and problems facing it just now. Very interesting. We'll maybe hear a question about that very subject in this press conference. Who knows? And we will talk about the roadmap when we've got the space to do so properly. Thanks to Rafa. They'll also be, of course, following EF Education First at the Giro, and look out for the EF Gone Racing films at rafa.cc. Subscribe to Rafa Films at YouTube. Shall we just crack on, Lionel? Let's hear the first question, shall we? You're going to chair this press conference. Are we going to go to our first caller?
Indeed. First question is from Ed.
Hi, guys. My name's Ed, and my question's really simple. Who's your favourite for the general classification at the Giro this year?
Hi there, guys. My name's Nick, and I'm from Leicester. Surely it's just between Tom Dumoulin and Primoz Roglic, right?
Well, two questions there. Who's your favourite for the GC, and is it just between Roglic and Dumoulin? Who's your favourite for the GC, Lionel?
Well, there's more to it than Roglic and Dumoulin, surely. Simon Yates, Miguel Angel Lopez.
Superman.
Yes. But I would say, with Mikel Landa as well, maybe, I'd say that's...
Nibali.
Oh, no, it's not. It's much more than just Dumoulin against Roglic, I think.
I think it's Roglic against Roglic. I mean, if we're to believe Dumoulin's utterances, that he's not in great shape, you know... Do we take that with a pinch of salt? He's quite honest to a fault sometimes, Dumoulin. So that could be right. There haven't been great signs from him of him being in form, but you know he's a more proven talent, isn't he? Now over 3 weeks, pretty dependable now, I would say. Whereas Roglic is on this kind of trajectory of rapid improvement. I can't really see. I do think that it's all kind of falling into place for Roglic. I mean, he went to Tour de Romandie apparently with the intention of supporting Stephen Kruijswijk, but clearly was going much better and almost ended up winning by accident, it seemed. So Roglic looks to me as if he's going to be very difficult to beat.
As regards Dumoulin, I would say that this year's Giro is very back-heavy. It's always very back-heavy, but this year more than ever, meaning that the first week contains a lot of sprint stages. There's not going to be a whole lot of GC action until the first time trial really to San Marino, which is where the race will really start for Dumoulin. So I think that's in his favour. If he's a bit undercooked, maybe it could disadvantage Roglic if he comes in firing and he's already nearing the sort of plateau of his form. So I would have those two about even. I think Simon Yates will probably climb better than both of them. The time trial San Marino, I think, will suit him to a certain extent as well. It's very much uphill in the second half. But Superman is going to be incredibly dangerous with the strongest team in the race, I would say, Astana. My one doubt about the Astana team is that they have loaded their team towards the mountains, and it's going to be a lot of pressure on Zaitz and Boaro in the first week to keep Superman out of trouble. Those stages on paper shouldn't be too insidious, but you know, as you sort of head towards the south of Italy, if it should rain one day, you know, we also have a lot of crashes in the south of Italy because the roads tend to be, you know, greasy and dusty. So that could be something to look out for.
Egan Bernal was one of the riders that we would have been really looking forward to seeing how he got on. Now not in the race simplifies it a little bit and does narrow that field down a bit. But I think you're right, Daniel, about the fact that it's not just that the Giro this year is so backloaded with all the mountain stages in the second half. It's that the first 9 days, really up until the time trial to San Marino, there's nothing really to trouble anybody. And there's certainly not the sort of stages we had last year where Simon Yates felt the necessity to kind of go out and try and win time bonuses and gain here and gain there. It will be a much more tranquilo opening 8 days.
The Italian started already.
Brilliant, isn't it? That wow. means tranquil, apparently, in English. Really getting in the swing of things.
A man is clearly in shape for the Giro.
But I think that's actually not to be underestimated, how that will alter certainly somebody like Simon Yates's approach to the race. Can afford to almost go into hibernation for the first week, just get through, avoid anything difficult, tricky or dangerous, doesn't need to go out and stretch. And then we'll just see when the first big mountain stages come, who's got their pacing right, really. Whether
Simon Yates could be in the pink jersey on Saturday evening.
Could be, yeah. But unlikely to want to defend that for a week. I mean, the prologue finishes. That's a tricky hill by the looks of it, San Luca.
Well, it's the climb that the Giro dell'Emilia finishes on every year. It's the climb where some people will remember Simon Gerrans famously, infamously dropped Chris Froome at the end of a stage in 2009. It's very 2 kilometres that are very steep, so 6 flat kilometres to the bottom of the climb, and then just a very steep rise to the finish.
If we take this long to answer each question, we could be here for 3 weeks.
Well, let's
shall we hear another one?
Let's crack on.
Hi, this is Mark speaking from Southwest London. My question to you guys regarding the Giro is, who do you think is going to be the standout sprinter from the group that are going? And in addition to that as well, do you think Bora will regret not sending Sam Bennett to the Giro, considering I think he's already racked up 6 wins so far this season and is looking very strong, impressively strong? Thanks again. Bye.
Well, Mark, as I see it, it looks to be Viviani versus Ewan versus Gaviria in the sprint stakes, and Bora Hansgrohe are taking Pascal Ackermann, the German, instead of Sam Bennett, and the spotlight will be on that, I think, because if Ackermann doesn't get a win, then that question will get asked, won't it? But the opening week, Daniel, there's a few really good opportunities for the sprinters, and then there's a couple of absolutely billiard table flat stages after the first rest day. It's plenty of opportunities for the sprinters, and what's going to be interesting is to see whether somebody gets on a roll and adds a second and a third, or whether they're going to share it out evenly. There's plenty of opportunity to see which of the sprinters is in the best form. What are the early signs so far?
Well, I would say, you know, based on the Tour de France last year, so Gaviria has gone right to the top of So even footing with Groenewegen at the top of the sprinters' hierarchy. Ewan and Gaviria haven't gone up against each other that often. My suspicion is that Ewan might end up being the quickest of all of these riders, all this kind of young generation eventually. But it's going to be interesting. He's got a team that's very much been picked to support him in the sprints with guys like Kluger. So he will have some no excuses, really. And he hasn't ridden a Grand Tour, I don't think, for 3 years now. I think it's a Giro in 2016. So maybe, you know, that's a question mark, but it's also another reason for him to be especially eager and motivated. And I think to really leave his mark on this Giro.
don't know if you mentioned Arnaud Démare, did you? He's also riding.
Yeah, he is also riding, but I don't think on the same level as the other. I could be proven wrong, of course. But he is riding, but you know, there are other sprinters. Other sprinters are available, Richard. I was just condensing it down to okay. a sort of an eye grabbing three-way fight.
As regards Ackermann, I mean, he's a German rider on a long-term contract with the German team, so they have to get him up and running in Grand Tour somehow, somewhere. And I think it might be some short-term pain for long-term gain for them, because Bennett is going to leave. I think we all know he's going to leave at the end of the season. Will Ackermann win a stage at this year's Giro? Maybe not, but you know, I think they'll hope that this sort of gets him up and running, and they can take him to the Tour de France next year, potentially. Obviously, hinges a lot on what Sagan is doing.
Ackermann did, of course, win the one-day race on May the 1st, the Frankfurt race, which I omitted from my news roundup. Gaviria helped out, maybe, or perhaps hindered by the fact that there's no Fabio Aru in the team. There'll be a lot of expectation on Gaviria's shoulders, although they do have the likes of Ulissi and Jan Polansch and you know, a couple of others who could go off and try and win stages. The one that will be really interesting is Viviani, Italian champion, so will be fired up to win stages. And obviously, De Koenig Quickstep is a winning machine. They do it every race. You'd be surprised if he didn't get off the mark fairly early on. Next question is from Lawrence.
Hi, chaps. Lawrence here, friend of the podcast in Stratford-upon-Avon. Looking forward to the Giro d'Italia coverage already. Daniel's Agri Turismo selections, Lionel's excellent Italian. But I wanted to know, which Italian riders should we be watching this year?
Daniel, that sounds like one for you.
Well, it's a pretty bare field as far as the Italians are concerned, certainly in terms of quality. I mean, the more interesting sort of, you know, left field hipster names that could be revelations would, most of them, I think, ride for Gianni Savio's team, Androni. So Matteo Cattaneo is a guy who, sort of the Fabio Aru generation, kind of went toe-to-toe with Aru as an amateur, was expected to have a great career. Hasn't been able to get out of the Pro Conti division, but he could go well. I think Fausto Masnada could be the revelation of the Giro, in the sense I think he could make the top 10. He rode his first Giro last year.
Won two stages at the Tour of the Alps recently.
Two stages? Wow. He was 26th on his first appearance in the Giro last year, but he seems to be improving. Also got a great nickname, the L'Anguilla di Brembilla, which is the eel of the Brembilla Valley, which is where he's from.
Do eels live in valleys?
Just outside Bergamo. Well, this was apparently coined by one of his teammates, erstwhile teammates, Davide Ballerini, who said that he looked like an eel, sort of squirming when he was attacking uphill.
Not because he's a slippery character.
No. Ah. Although, having said that, a Masnada, talking of slippery characters, is kind of a group of slippery characters. It's kind of like a gang or a posse of very slippery characters.
Carrying on the Italian theme, let's hear Neil's question.
Hello, this is Neil Halliday. I have a question for Daniel for the Giro press conference. I'd like to know who he thinks the next Italian winner of the Giro could be, which team they'd ride for, and if he knows of any young Italian protagonists that could be coming through the ranks that could be future winners.
Next Italian Giro winner, there is absolutely no one that I can see. No one, even going way back to the junior ranks at the moment. If you look at sort of the landmark races, even like the Giro della Val d'Aosta, races like that that have been good predictors of success in the Giro, they've been dominated in the last couple of years by foreigners. I can't really see anyone. There are a couple of good Italians riding for Ivan Basso and Alberto Contador's feeder team, the Cometa team, but no one who I think could one day win the Giro.
Do you think it's more likely that Vincenzo Nibali could win the Giro again than a new Italian win it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he will, but he's probably going to get closer than some of the sort of 19, 20-year-olds. I can't really see anyone.
And is this all a consequence of there being no Italian World Tour teams, or does the Bahrain Merida and UAE Team Emirates they're basically Italian teams, aren't they? In, you know, in everything but the source of the money, is that having an impact?
I think so. I mean, it's a lack of money. If you sort of you make a comparison between, you could say the Italian scene at the moment looks a bit like the French scene did at the start of the sort of noughties. But at that point, the French teams were very good at investing in like sports science and, you know, physiologists, psychologists, and they were, you know, because they had the guaranteed participation in the tour, they were attracting a reasonable amount of money, and yeah, consequently they were able to build these pretty, you know, pretty good sort of infrastructure and pretty good support, which just hasn't happened in Italy. I mean, the French economy has been stronger than the Italian economy over the last 20 years. That's a factor. You look at the Italian teams, they're small budget teams. You know, they're sort of 2 million euro a year teams, and you simply can't afford to, you know, have four physiologists and you know, send guys for wind tunnel testing and so forth and so forth. And I think that's reflected even lower down the pyramid in under 23 racing and junior racing. There's just not much money available. So, you know, Italian cycling has really lacked sort of figureheads and people that are going to resonate with a younger audience and get them riding.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, interrupting the press conference to remind us to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Harry's. The guys behind Harry's razors knew that there was only one way to ensure the quality they wanted, so they bought their own factory, and now, by selling over the internet, they offer their razor blades at about half the price of some other brands. Richard, you can vouch for their quality. Presumably you wouldn't let them near your face if you felt otherwise, but the question I've got this week is, after my limerick and Rose's haiku, do you have anything to say about Harry's inverse?
No, sorry, Lionel. I haven't succeeded in that. I did wonder about a metaphysical poem or maybe a sonnet, appropriately enough for this week, with the Giro starting, and sonnets originate from Italy, of course. But the Giro is also the reason that I'm not reading a sonnet, because I've been too busy getting ready for the race, digging out my passport, packing my Harry's razors. Instead, I'll urge you to go back, that's you, the listeners, and listen to Rose's haiku and Lionel's limerick, while telling you that Harry's have a special offer for Cycling Podcast listeners, a trial set for £3.95, which includes everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover, which I've got in my wash bag for the Giro.
You can get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including the razor handle, the 5 blade cartridge, foaming shave gel and travel blade cover, by going to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling.
You're listening to Kilometer Zero by the Cycling Podcast, in association with Hans Grohe Showers and Taps.
My philosophy is to honor the race, to be protagonist, always to attack, to be present in breakaway. Big passion is to discover young rider, to discover talents. I try always to see if there are young riders, and sometime in country unknown. This is my big passion, to change the life in the point economy of people that is in difficult, maybe, that is in poor family, and cycling represents for them to change his position.
Shower like a pro with Hans Grohe Showers and Taps.
Well, we heard there a little teaser of our Kilometer Zero episodes that will come at the Giro. There'll be 9 in total, Monday, Wednesday and Friday. A big thank you to Hans Grohe, who are sponsoring Kilometer Zero at all 3 Grand Tours this year, at the Giro, Tour de France and the Vuelta a España. big thanks to them for allowing us to release those to you through all the Grand Tours. There'll be 15 at the Tour, 9 at the Giro, and 9 at the Vuelta. Just to, if you're not familiar with Club Zero, if you're new to the cycling podcast, they are they're sort of magazine features in audio form, aren't they? That come out in the morning and provide a sort of sideways look at the race or the riders or the teams or some other aspect around the race. So the first episode of Club Zero at the Giro will come out on Monday, and it's thanks to Hansgrohe. We heard in that clip from one of the Club Zero episodes last year, that was Gianni Savio, which links nicely to the point you were making earlier, Daniel, about inspirational figures in Italian cycling. I guess Gianni Savio is it, isn't he?
Pretty much. I don't know what kind of person would be inspired by Gianni Savio.
Much loved character anyway. And the Giro's full of them. Shall we hear some more questions, Lionel?
Indeed. Well, let's take some questions about the route and about Italy in general. First, Andrew from Sydney.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. Andrew from Sydney. I'd like to know, for the Giro, which stages should be watched live, which you think will be explosive, as I need to share the TV at home. Thank you.
Well, this is very simple, Napalm. You need to watch the whole of the prologue. You need to watch the last 20 minutes of stages 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 and 18. The last hour of stages 7, 8, 12, 15 and all of stages 13, 14, 16, 17, 19 and 20.
Brilliant.
Not sure the person sharing the television with Andrew is going to be delighted at that news.
That's quite a lot of TV time.
That's quite a lot.
If he's in Sydney, will it not be in the middle of the night? Surely won't be too difficult to monopolise the TV
much,
in the middle of the night.
Too much for my brain to process at the moment. But that's very, very comprehensive.
And left out the time trials. Watch as much as you like of the time trials.
How much will you be watching, Daniel? That's the key.
Well, all of it.
Of course, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. They are actually, well, there are interesting things about all the time trials. The first one, we talked about the climb to the Madonna, the San Luca, which is going to be spectacular. The San Marino one's going to be interesting, because I've never been to San Marino.
Well, it's 35K or thereabouts, and it really is a race of two halves, but the second half isn't quite half, but it's flat at the start and then relentlessly upwards in the last sort of 10 kilometres or so. Looks like it's going to be a tricky one to pace. And then, of course, the Verona one. Well, what will we see on the final day? Maybe it will be a head-to-head. The pink jersey will still be up for grabs, and we'll be wondering which of the two gentlemen of Verona will be crowned Giro champion. Bit of Shakespeare there, bit of culture.
Yeah. I mean, the Giro's got a pretty good track record with these final day time trials, doesn't it?
It has.
You know, Dumoulin going from fourth to first on the final day a couple of years ago. And did the not finish with a time trial when it finished in Verona before?
Correct, 2010 when Basso won. And in 1984 when Francesco Moser famously beat Laurent Fignon, and Fignon was very aggrieved about the helicopters flying above him, wasn't it? Moser. And the sort of air current created by the helicopter, making it more difficult for him.
Yeah, well, no, nothing untoward about that. Next question, please.
For someone who's new to watching professional cycling, like I am, what makes the Giro stand out from the other Grand Tours? Thanks.
I like the Giro, I think, the best of all the Grand Tours. I think there is a sort of a festivity about the Giro that doesn't exist anymore at the Tour or the Vuelta. I think Italy as a country lends itself particularly well to a Grand Tour, in the sense that I think part of it is just the shape of the country, the peninsula, and Italy's such a young country that it was only unified in the 1860s, and the regional sort of variation is so great that when you're moving up the peninsula, that sort of variation is vertical, really, and it's almost like it's a cocktail that hasn't in a tall thin glass that hasn't been shaken yet, Italy. And so whenever you move sort of an hour north or south, you get into a different layer, and that applies to the language, it applies to all the dialects, it applies to the landscape, it applies to the food, it applies to mentalities. Whereas, you know, obviously the sort of picture in France and Spain is a lot more jumbled. You know, you can go west and not really notice that much difference, or you can go north and not notice that much difference, or on the other hand, you can go east and it can feel like a different country. But in Italy, it's very much sort of vertical, and that's also why you know, there's a lot of talk always in Italy about the north versus the south, and whether even they should be, you know, separate countries. So I think that's really, really interesting. In Italy, there are a lot of towns built on top of hills, which you know, so there are a lot of exciting stage finishes by virtue of that. And it's a, I think there's also maybe a deeper cycling culture than there is in Spain or France. In France, there's a culture and a love of the Tour de France. In Italy, although it's dwindled maybe in the last 20 or 30 years, there's still a general appreciation for the sport of cycling.
There's also a sense, Daniel, which you've spoken about before, of there's a real sort of warm welcome extended on the Giro to visitors, and we are among the visitors. There's a sense that you don't get in France, certainly. You get to some extent in Spain as well, but in Italy, a real sense of gratitude almost for the fact that you're there, that you're enjoying their country, enjoying their food, and that's reflected in the food that you get as well, where, you know, there's great love poured into the dishes that you tend to get in the most sort of humble places for very little money. It does feel, and I can, you know, some of the experiences that we've had at the Giro, staying places, is a real sense of warmth, and I think gratitude is, it feels like the right word.
I'd say you often mock me for describing the Vuelta as a holiday grand tour in Spain, but if I had to say, if the Vuelta is the holiday grand tour, the Tour de France feels like business, doesn't it? It's so important to everybody who's there. It's the biggest thing of the year. There's almost that kind of tension and almost defensiveness about the race. It's almost too big for its own good. Whereas the Giro feels like a travelogue. It feels like, you know, Michael Palin or Richard Ayoade going off discovering somewhere new, and it feels like more of an adventure, more of an exploration of a place and its culture and its people than probably the other two put together.
I think there's a sense, I don't want to indulge in national stereotypes too much, but there's a sense of complacency sometimes around the tour, from, you know, route design to everything about the tour, but that's also again maybe reflected in French cuisine to some extent. Whereas Italy is still feels like it's trying really hard, and
there's a pride in very small things. And I know, Daniel, you mock us lightheartedly for our insistence on having an afternoon cappuccino, and I push back against that by ordering cappuccino
for the record,
after dinner.
We never have an afternoon cappuccino.
But I think there's something
lunchtime, yeah.
There's something lovely about the number of times we've been somewhere where the waiter or waitress has said, oh, you must try this, or, you know, they bring out an extra course of something because they know you're not from the area, not local, and there's a real sense of pride in the things that define their region over the other regions.
Yeah. There's also something intangible about the Italians of being in Italy. There's a kind of latent drama about everything in Italy, and if you've ever worked with Italians, you'll know what I mean. But there's a quote that I'm very fond of from one of the most famous Italian sort of contemporary social commentators, journalist Beppe Severgnini, who said that Italy is a place where something is always about to happen. Usually it's something quite uncommon. Normality for us is quite exceptional. And I think they sort of revel in that. They're not particularly comfortable with status quo, calm, you know, serenity. Their status quo, or what they like and gravitate towards, is drama and melodrama a lot of the time. And I think that's reflected in the race and the way the race sort of pans out.
Yeah, whether it be Chris Froome's attack and Simon Yates's collapse, or Tom Dumoulin having to answer the unpleasant call of nature on the roadside, there is a kind of high drama, high theatre almost to the things that happen at the Giro that you don't necessarily, I can't think of the equivalents at the Tour. The Tour, like I say, feels like business, and it is very important to everybody, of course, and there's lots to love about it. But
yeah, I mean, if you think of famous incidents in the past where, I don't know, bridges have collapsed or there have been protesters on the route. You know, that you almost, you get the impression that sometimes at the Tour, that's seen as a terror, as a disaster and a catastrophe and something that should be avoided at all costs in future. Whereas those similar things that have happened at the Giro have almost been mythologized and celebrated, you know, from the Stelvio in 1988 to, you know, when everyone almost got hypothermia and it became this sort of legendary episode. There are a few of those in the history of the Tour and the Vuelta.
They embrace the chaos, a bit like driving around any of the big cities. I mean, it's chaos. You know, if you're on the roundabout, it's your right of way, basically. And if you're not on the roundabout, it's still your right of way. I mean, that seems to be how it works. Next question.
Hello, Richard, Daniel and Lionel. This is Andy Gladstone again from New York. My question for you is, with this year's Gran Partenza taking place in Italy, sandwiched between 2 years, last year in Jerusalem and next year in Hungary, where the journalists and cyclists will have to travel after a few stages to be able to make it to mainland Italy, how does that affect your preparation for the race as a journalist? And how does it affect the cyclists' preparation with the lack of additional travel that they will need this year and ability to get straight into the Giro? Again, love the coverage. Thank you very much for keeping me company on the train every morning into my office in downtown Brooklyn. I have been enjoying it and looking forward to the Kilometer Zeros daily during the Giro.
Thanks, Andy. Well, this year does contrast quite markedly with last year, doesn't it, in Israel? And that was... that was a big, big departure, obviously, for us. It meant there were only two of us there for the start, and then you joined up with Daniel in Italy, Lionel. You know, it was an interesting experience. The stages themselves didn't do a lot to the race, and so it felt sort of like a prelude to the Giro rather than the Giro itself, and I can see, obviously, why the Giro in particular does this. There's a lot of money at stake. But it does feel as if you're just delaying the start of the race itself, in a way. And I don't know, I can't think of many starts to any of the Grand Tours on foreign soil where the race has really caught fire. Can you?
No, there's a sense, and certainly in Israel, there was a feeling that, you know, everyone just get through without crashing or, you know, slipping out of contention. Just survive, yeah. Kind of the couple of days of racing and then get back for the real start. And that is in common with all of the foreign...
Someone will come back now with an example of one that has really put the cam on the pigeons, but I can't think of many. And so it feels like a I don't want to say necessary evil, because that's too negative a connotation, but it doesn't feel like it adds an awful lot to the race. Whereas in Bologna on Saturday, you know, with this very interesting first stage time trial, you feel like that'll be the race kind of on, and you know,
I don't think I've ever been to a start in Italy. Actually, every start I've been to has been,
well, Sardinia.
Oh yeah, of course, Sardinia. Sorry.
A couple of years ago.
But even that wasn't on the... Even that had the feeling of, oh, we've got to do a few days before we then get a flight. And there's always that sort of, from our point of view even, that anxiety of getting the flight, the logistics of the transfer. Even, Daniel, the 2 years we've had to go from Sicily to the mainland on the ferry at night, and the kind of the tension of that, are we going to get across tonight? Will we get to our hotel and have dinner at a reasonable hour? And I think... even last year when we got across and we'd driven down into that little town after coming across from Sicily and seeing Chris Froome just turning up, because he'd missed a helicopter, hadn't he, to fly them across from Etna. Just a sense of relief that everybody, the next morning when it resumes, you know, right, we're just here now, and now the race, kind of, we can all get into our rhythm. It feels like it's slightly detached, slightly disjointed, but sometimes, you know, no worse for that. It's you know, I think the Netherlands three years ago was, you know, that felt like a real party for the weekend, didn't it? Because the people there really embraced the race.
Hi, Steve Down from Somerset. It's a question for Daniel. I very much enjoyed the Montefalco Sagrantino that you recommended in a previous Giro. What other wines are there on this year's route that I won't have heard of that I will enjoy as much? Thank you.
Well, Daniel, that's one for you, our wine
hang on,
expert.
Hang on, is it not one for me?
Definitely not for you. This is a source of tension, isn't it? I wouldn't say so.
No, I'm happy to just drink the wine that Daniel recommends. That's fine. And he's happy if I don't offer my tasting notes.
Yeah. Wine. It's not the greatest. It's not a vintage Giro for wines this year. It's more a Giro for lovers of white wine, I would suggest. Napalm, we're going to go on a little wine-related excursion on the stage that finishes in Frascati, which is a fairly famous white wine produced outside Rome. But we are not that. That is not going to be the focus of our detour. Shall I reveal now?
If you wish.
I'm going to take you to discover a white wine called Est di Montefiascone. And there's a very interesting story behind the name of Est di Montefiascone. And you're not allowed to do any research. You're not allowed to Google it beforehand.
Okay, I won't. I'll just look forward to tasting it.
And beyond that, well, you and I think you're still on the race then, Napalm. We are staying in Barbaresco, home of very famous Piedmontese red wine. But that is on the day, well, there's a stage finish in Novi Ligure, Fausto Coppi country. And then the following day, we're starting in Cuneo. But we are staying halfway to Cuneo in Barbaresco, near Barolo. So that's the heart of Piedmontese red wine country.
That will be a good day. I think I'm still there then. My stint is the first 2 weeks, give or take.
But the wine stage this year is a little bit anticlimactic. I mean, it's a sort of nominal wine stage. The wine in question is Sangiovese, which is a great variety, but it's there's a lot of that produced in the Emilia-Romagna region, and the wine stage is the one that goes to San Marino, the time trial, but we cut through that country. And I'm sure we'll find something worth drinking. We'll probably speak to Pier Bergonzi of the Gazzetta, who is I think he's the vice editor now of the Gazzetta. He's also a qualified sommelier. We speak to him every year on that day.
Lovely. But you'll be returning home, of course, Lionel, to not drink champagne in the middle of the Giro.
Indeed, yes. Well, somebody emailed us to say that I'm only allowed to mention once prior to my departure why I'm leaving the Giro for a weekend, and once on my return, so I can't reveal any more at this stage. Last question for this section.
Hi, guys. Thomas WP here, a long-time friend of the podcast. The Giro's talked about starting in Japan, which I guess means three stages, followed by two rest days, and then the rest of the Giro. I'd be interested in whether you think that's a three-day race, followed by an 18-day race with two rest days. Perhaps a solution to the two rest days is, whilst they fly home, having a Zwift race in the air, giving us in-the-air, indoor, virtual cycling. I'd be particularly interested in Daniel's views on that. Thanks a lot.
No. A Zwift stage, I would not approve of.
On a plane. Literally to a new level, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That would be the altitude. I mean, you know, Christian Prudhomme's boasted about this year's tour being the highest grand tour in history.
30,000 feet.
Where on
earth would they train for this?
I think, as I said at the time, Rich, I think the 1998... tour was pretty high as well. Some boys getting pretty high that year.
But the Giro does push the envelope more than the Tour and the Vuelta. The Giro's probably slightly wealthier than the Vuelta, although the Vuelta, of course, is backed by ASO. The Tour's so big that there are logistical restrictions to what it could do, whereas the Giro is on the size of it means that they could entertain going to New York or Japan. I mean, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that if the money was right, that they would be asking the UCI for permission to do something like that.
I think there has been a plan afoot to start in Brooklyn in New York. I think there have been talks about that. And yeah, there's been talk of Japan. Logistically, New York is just about feasible, possibly with a second rest day or a short time trial.
Not that much further than Israel, really.
No, and a short time trial on the way on their return to Italy or a sort of afternoon stage, not impossible.
But again, to the earlier point, it would feel even more detached, I think. And there'd be a reluctance, I think, on the part of the organisers to make those stages too meaningful, to make them too challenging in a way. And so the race suffers from that. I can see from the point of view of the spectacles, you know, expanding the brand to America in particular and Japan, I'm sure it get huge response there. I can see why all that makes sense, but I don't think it adds to the race. I don't think it enhances the race at all.
We did mention the Zwift, the idea that there might be a Zwift.
Well, I think it's more than an idea, isn't it?
Yeah. But the idea would be that it would be just a sort of ceremonial thing to decide who wears the pink jersey for the first proper stage, wouldn't it? I mean, they wouldn't be taking the times and adding them to the GC results. I wouldn't have thought.
I don't imagine so. Just on the point of Grand Départ. I mean, it's in their interest, the organizers' interest, to talk up the possibility of going to far-flung or exotic places. So often you'll hear rumours of the tour starting somewhere when it might be just a conversation or a contact. You know, I remember when the people from Scotland met with Christian Prudhomme and ASO about bringing the... It was an informal meeting during the Rugby World Cup in 2007, and a few weeks later Prudhomme mentioned it in an interview, and that caught them on the hop. But you know, it's not like they will keep that under wraps. Any mention of interest from Edinburgh or, you know, anywhere else will, they would hope, generate interest elsewhere and increase the sense of competition and allow them to raise the price. So you often hear rumours of the Giro or the Tour de Vuelta starting somewhere, and it might be very, very tenuous.
The Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
A big thank you to Science in Sport for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. And an anniversary for us with Science in Sport, because it was the 2016 Giro d'Italia that they came in to help support our coverage there, really enabling us to go and cover it. And they've been a big part of our, I suppose, the journey that we've been on ever since. And thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport. They are terrific partners for us and for you, because they're offering 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 for all your Science and Sport products. We've got another question for Science and Sport this week from Phil Hopley. Thanks very much for all your questions. Please send them to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com or leave a voice memo at the WhatsApp number. And must say at this point as well, thank you very much to you all for your questions for this press conference episode. We'll be doing more of these throughout the Giro, but we really appreciate all the correspondence that we've been getting. Same email, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. In the meantime, here is Phil Hopley's letter. I've recently started listening to the Cycling Podcast, particularly on my commutes. I can't believe it's taken me so long to become a listener, he says. That's nice. Thank you, Phil. I have a question for your Science and Sports slot. Cycling literature is regularly reminding us of the importance of protein. I currently have some Go bars with protein. For what type of rider are they best suited? Long and steady, or eating small bits in between hard efforts in an interval session? Thanks. Keep up what you're doing. Thank you, Phil. And over to you, Ben Samuels at Science and Sport.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for reaching out. I'd suggest Go Energy Plus protein bars are definitely more suited to the longer, steadier type rides as part of your overall fueling plans. Including a protein option around the halfway mark of a long ride is a new strategy that we're starting to see being used. The benefits of the Go Energy Plus protein bar is it will then still provide carbohydrate for energy production. Protein feeding during exercise isn't generally needed in the interval type sessions. Those sessions with hard efforts will largely be carbohydrate dependent. In addition, the high intensity type nature of those is going to further challenge the digestive system. In that way, you'd be better to use a carbohydrate based drink or isotonic gels to fuel and refuel around your interval sessions.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, chaps, we've moved inside, hence the plinky plonky background music that you might be hearing. We've just had lunch, so there's been a bit of a gap since you last heard from us, and now we are all the other side of a very nice meal.
Your birthday celebrations, Richard. Happy birthday.
Thank you, Lionel. It's a real... I mean, to celebrate my birthday with you too has been...
Underwhelming.
All I could ever...
So sincere.
All I could ever hope for.
So sincere.
Anyway, we've got a few more questions to get to. But before we do, we've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast that we are going to be selling exclusive mugs, cycling podcast mugs, during the Giro d'Italia. When I say we are selling them, they're going to be sold by Stacey Snyder, an American ceramicist, friend of the podcast. And she has come up with these beautifully designed mugs. They are really lovely objects and, you know, reassuringly big and heavy and just beautifully designed and produced. So they'll be for sale during the Giro. We'll do different mugs for the Tour and the Vuelta, but all the money raised by these mugs will go to a good cause. We've asked for your nominations for good causes, and we were inundated with suggestions, and it's been really, really hard. We've been over lunch actually going through some of your nominations. Really, really tough decision, and in fact we weren't in the end able to make a decision, so we've chosen two. We're going to split the money between two good causes, one on either side of the Atlantic. So one of the good causes is the Kelly Catlin Fund. Kelly Catlin recently died by suicide, Olympic gold medalist at the Rio Games in Team Pursuit. Somebody we had on the podcast a couple of years ago, very talented violinist, academic, a really, really sad tragedy that she died recently. A fund has been set up in her name. It'd be run by USA Cycling, but the family, the Catlin family, will be very involved in deciding how the money is spent. Concussion was perhaps a factor in her death, so it may well, some of the money may well go to research around concussion. I'm speculating a bit there, but we felt that the Kelly Catlin Fund was well worth supporting. So half of the money from the Giro mugs will go to the Kelly Catlin Fund. The other half will go to the Ride for Charlie Foundation. This is a charity set up to remember Charlie Craig, who was a very promising young British rider, particularly a cyclocross rider. His father, Nick Craig, was a very good mountain biker and cyclocross rider as well. And he died tragically in his sleep. I mean, there's a little note on the website about Charlie. Charlie was a special boy. He went to sleep on Friday the 20th of January and didn't wake up. He was 15. He left his family and friends in a state of shock, an incredible hole in our hearts. We miss him more every day. There's more information about this charity, which goes to support young riders, with an emphasis on cyclocross and mountain biking, at rideforcharlie.com. That's rideforcharlie.com. So we'll be splitting the money raised by the mugs sold during the Giro between those two good causes. And you'll find the mugs. The mugs will go on sale on Saturday, the day that the Giro begins. They're limited editions, so get in there quickly. You'll find them for sale at stacysnyder.com. That's stacysnyder.com. Any problems with that, give us a shout on email, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. But stacysnyder.com for all the sales of the mugs. And thank you for all your nominations. Next question, please, Lionel.
I think we've got time for three last questions, please. Three last questions, the first of which is from John in Sussex.
Hi, guys. John McGowan, friend of the podcast in Sussex here. I suppose this question's a bit of a cliche, but the Giro for the last few years has just been so much more exciting than the Tour de France. And there may be all sorts of reasons for that, more open racing, etc., etc. You've touched on them many times. If you were to be allowed to take over the Tour de France for 2020 and change it in whatever way you wanted, there's obviously a long tradition of journalists setting courses in the Tour de France, but if you, the three of you, were given the opportunity to change it and inject some of the excitement that we've come to associate with the Giro in the last few years, what would you do? It can be anything, team sizes, team budgets, routes, rolling routes, high routes, low routes, anything you like. What would you do? Thanks.
Well, chaps, I would hold it in Italy and call it the Giro. Things that the Tour de France could do to potentially make it more exciting. Try to take the race on some narrower roads. I think that would make it a bit more interesting. More of a scrap for positions. Fewer summit finishes. I think already that's a trend that's Christian Prudhomme and Thierry Gouvenot, the men most responsible for the Tour route, are starting to sort of embrace after years and years of gone.
Well, people tune in for the summit finishes, don't they?
Yeah, so I think they're boring. I think they're generally quite boring. No?
Well,
if there is a summit finish, I would like them to reintroduce the very short-lived rule whereby riders could dispense with their helmets at the bottom of climbs, because I think that's quite important in terms of audience engagement with the riders. The fact they can see their, you know, if they can see their faces, I think that's...
Well, they'd have to get rid of the sunglasses as well, then,
well,
on that basis.
Well, the sunglasses, yeah. But it is quite striking. If you go back and watch the 2003 Tour de France, the sort of difference it makes to the way you watch it and the way you engage with the protagonists is quite, significant, really. Slightly more radical. I've talked about this before. I think it would be in cycling's interest, and particularly in the Grand Tour's interest, to shift more emphasis onto teams. And I would like to see a sponsored, 1 million euros or more, 2 million euros in prize money for the team classification. Every team, in order for their best place riders' result to count on general classification, five or six riders from that team have to finish the Grand Tour. Ooh. A bit like a team time trial. Or... the introduction of a team time limit every day.
A team time limit? So yes. You couldn't have, say, three riders all in the gruppetto clocking up 45 minutes each?
Correct.
Interesting. That's of those three ideas, I think that's the most interesting, because I think the other two, the team classification, really, what, as Francois always says, the Grand Tours are individual races tested by teams. It's not a team prize, is it?
I think it's something that the lay audience finds it difficult to understand, and I think it would be in the interest, particularly from the point of view of the business model, and if you look at what sponsors try to get out of cycling, you know, the message that they try to put across, I think it would be, you know, it would be good to leverage the notion of a team, and I don't think it does that well at the moment. I think it's difficult for people to make the link between an individual winning and what their team actually does for them.
I mean, I think there should be a team stage race, certainly in the World Tour, where there is no individual classification at all, and teams clock up points by, you know, stage positions or getting in breakaways or intermediate sprints or whatever. I can definitely see that as a very valid format, and saying this is the best stage racing team of the year from, I don't know, maybe make it the Dauphiné or something. You know, pick a race and change the format. But I don't know whether for the Tour de France, whether that would really capture the imagination and say, you know, I don't know. I still think that the whole thing about the Tour de France is who wins the yellow jersey, and the same with the Giro. These races do stand above the other stage races as great individual tests of stamina and tactics and durability and mental strength.
In that case, do away with teams.
Yeah, well, 1 year, why not? You can only... Yeah, no one's allowed to work together. No slipstreaming.
Individual sponsors.
Sponsorship online. Crowdfunding sponsorship. Yeah.
Wow. I'm torn on this because I totally see the logic in what you're saying, but at the same time, I find it it's always quite fascinating to look at how teams are managing their resources as well. And so when you see a team giving a climbing domestique a day off, it's then interesting to think about how that will play out on a different day. You know, it's all part of the complexity of the sport that we kind of like, that does make it, by its very definition, complex.
To Mark Cavendish about this recently, and he is of the view, this is an idea that I've sort of put forward before in the Tour, that the general classification should be purely in terms of team. So if Chris Froome is winning the Tour de France, what you should read at the top of the general classification is Team Ineos or Team Sky, as it formerly was, not Chris Froome. But is that, you know, is that just a sort of a notional gimmick that people will see through? I don't know.
I think we project our own analysis onto these things sometimes, and sometimes that gets backed up by talking to team staff and riders, and sometimes, you know, it's just kind of speculation. But I think that's one of the things that I remember Mark Cavendish saying, you know, is there any value in seeing the sprinters all slog their way over the mountains when really what you want is to see the sprinters going head to head on the flat stages? So maybe there's an argument for bigger tour teams of maybe 15 or 16, and in order to qualify to win the race, you have to ride every stage, but then you swap in and out your special teams. You bring your sprinters in for the flat stages and your mountain domestiques for the mountain stages, and adds a whole team selection dynamic to it, which is kind of what, you know, if you think of other sports, team sports, that's what a lot of the media speculation is all about. Who's going to get picked? Who's going to get left out? How are the tactics going to work? And that's one aspect that cycling doesn't really convey terribly well. And also, when you're in the thick of a grand tour and you ask these questions, you can go and have the frankest conversation off the record with Dave Brailsford about what they're planning to do. But he's very reluctant to kind of say on tape, yeah, well, we're saving Egan Bernal for the last week or whatever. And so those stories never really get told. And I think that's where the sort of the narrative-driven thing kind of falls down a bit.
I mean, I just think that there's two, you know, there are 190 riders or whatever, 170, 180 riders in the peloton, and there comes a point in many stages of many stage races where the only thing interesting or relevant happening is at the front of the race and regards five or six riders. I think it'd be, you know, if there was more of a team element introduced, like a team time limit, then all of a sudden there'd be lots of interesting things going back through the bunch that would be happening, be worth following.
Can I just say, before we hear the next question, which we're about to do, I neglected to say who had nominated these good causes for the mugs. So Kevin Taylor it was who nominated the Kelly Catlin Fund, and it was Brian Powell who suggested the Ride for Charlie Foundation. So thanks, Kevin and Brian. And just finally on that, as well as the Stacey's own website, you can go to her Etsy page. Etsy, is that how you pronounce it? Etsy. That's etsy.com/shop/SnyderCeramics, SnyderCeramics, ceramics. etsy.com/shop/SnyderCeramics. Please, the next question.
Hello, chaps. Matt Sully here, calling from the Gold Coast of Australia. I'm a Pom living down here. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work. We really enjoy listening to it every week. Can't wait to when it comes out. One of the things I'd hope you would cover off, I know you have just touched on it briefly, but it's going to become quite a big issue in the coming weeks, is Ineos and their position as the world's number one manufacturer of single-use plastics, and the controversy and the contradiction and the hypocrisy that Team Sky, an organization that over the last few years has been about clean up the planet and save the whales and all about green, as soon as there's some money on the table, they're off to Ineos. And, you know, it's just a dreadful, dreadful company to have them aligned with. And I wonder whether Rod Ellingworth has moved camps, because he just can't stomach the idea of the hypocrisy of what's happening just for a few dollars. You know, it'd be really good if one of the big name riders, maybe Quito or one of the other big guys, just went, no, I'm not going to ride for a company that manufactures single-use plastics and pollutes the planet and makes a profit. Anyway, that's my views. I'm going to find it very difficult as an Englishman to continue to support that team, and that's sad. But there's no way I could support that team or ever buy any of their merchandise. I wouldn't mind if you guys have a debate about it and see what other people think. Thanks, guys. Keep up the good work.
Well, very strongly expressed opinion there from Mark about Team Ineos. One that a lot of people will have sympathy with and will agree with, and which some people may well not agree with, or may see the inconsistencies in holding Ineos to one standard and Astana and Katusha to another. You know, there's not been the same level of scrutiny of the financing and sponsorship of those teams as there has in recent weeks regarding Ineos. It's probably fair to say there's not been the same level of debate around sponsorship in other sports. I don't see much debate about Gazprom sponsorship of the Champions League in recent years, for example. But Daniel, Richard, you were both in Yorkshire for the Tour de Yorkshire. What was the atmosphere like? Did you witness any protests?
I did witness protests. I was at the start of stage one, and that was when a big protest was expected. It wasn't perhaps as big as some had anticipated. And, you know, they made quite a noise and had quite a presence around the Team Ineos bus in the morning. And that didn't look great, you know. And I was wondering around other teams as well. And, you know, it was not a good look for a team that was... It was his launch, you know, and you thought, what kind of thinking went into this? Who decided it was a good idea to unveil Team Ineos in Yorkshire, where, you know, fracking is going on and is hugely controversial, and Ineos are involved in that? That was strange. So the protests were there and perhaps weren't as disruptive as some people thought they might be. I thought that Dave Brailsford struck the wrong tone, really, at the end of that first stage, because he came off the bus and said to some journalists, there was a sort of sense that he played down the protests, as if they had sort of won the argument. And I think that the problem with that is that whether there were a lot of protesters or not, I think those protesters probably speak for a lot of people, that a lot of people are on their side, whether they're by their side or not. And it's such a the debate around global warming or climate change, should I say, and pollution and biodiversity, these are all really hot topics, and they're only going to get hotter. And whether there are a lot of people at the moment prepared to stand and protest and make a big fuss about it, I think those people represent an awful lot of other people. And so I don't think it was a great look again to claim some kind of victory over the protesters by the fact that they didn't have the impact that perhaps had been feared.
Daniel, you were at the actual press conference where the Ineos sponsorship was launched and unveiled. What was it like there, and what did you make of what Dave Brailsford and Jim Ratcliffe said?
Well, one of the charges that's already been levelled at Ineos and Sir Jim Ratcliffe is that this is all about greenwashing. The strong sense that I got from that press conference was that it's purely a vanity project. And if you read profiles of Sir Jim Ratcliffe and articles about Ineos and their activities going back several years, one thing that's consistently mentioned is that it's a public with huge dimensions and a tiny or an almost non-existent profile. And as far as I can tell, that is a scenario that suited them perfectly, and it would have suited them going forward. And actually, it doesn't do them any favours to be attracting. They don't really want publicity. That is just, you know, logically, that's kind of... what I can imagine. They're not a company that needs to appeal to consumers on a granular level. They're dealing with governments and unions, and so they're not looking for publicity. And even, you know, the way Jim Ratcliffe was talking and what we've subsequently found out about his plans in other sports with the 2-hour marathon and so forth, suggests to me that, you know, as he has said, he's doing it because he can, and it's almost a whimsical retirement sort of slush fund kind of activity that, you know, he just it's a sort of bucket list kind of thing from his personal point of view. That might be very, very naive, and, you know, there's maybe a more insidious level on which the greenwashing is taking place, but that was the sense that I got.
What about you, Lionel? What do you think?
Well, what I think is that I can see the arguments about if you hold one sponsoring company to account, then you must hold them all to account. I think that there's validity to that. On the other hand, you know, Ineos is a company that you know, it's a legitimate company. Its business is continuing regardless of its sponsorship of a cycling team or, you know, a quest to break the 2-hour marathon barrier. And so it's not, is it for sports to regulate companies that harness the earth resources for profit. I mean, that's beyond the remit of sport, it seems to me. There's no rules in place to say that these companies can sponsor cycling and those can't, or you know, certainly none that apply to Ineos. However, from Jim Ratcliffe's comments about fracking, and there's kind of two elements to this, isn't there? There's the fracking aspect and the single-use plastics aspect, and the impact brought more broadly on the environment. You know, at the start of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, I was talking to Dave Brailsford, asking whether he was anticipating protests in Yorkshire, and you know, he was saying how he'd found out a lot more about what Ineos does, and you know, I think once people have learned what they do, you know, maybe some of the concerns would be alleviated, etc., etc. And I said, would you be happy if fracking was taking place near your home? And he thought for a moment and then said, no, I probably wouldn't. And I don't even think that's a very controversial view. I don't think anyone would really want fracking taking place on their doorstep, no matter how many times Jim Ratcliffe says, well, all we do is pump water down and it's fine. Because I think it's more contentious than that. And I think that as a sort of PR exercise, saying that people who have concerns about fracking, dismissing those concerns as just ignorance, I don't think is a great look. And I also think that it's possible to think different things about different aspects of this. It is possible to ride a carbon fibre bike, as I do, and yet have concerns about carbon footprint. It's possible to do things to try and alleviate your own impact on the planet in small ways, whilst having grander ambitions for the big companies and the billionaires who are making decisions and deciding policy and making the biggest impact. And so when it comes down to the sport, and this isn't a cop-out at all, it's up to individuals whether they want to assert some kind of pressure on a sports team because of the identity and the business of their sponsors. Some people boycotted Team Sky or didn't like Team Sky because of Rupert Murdoch and links to that. So I think it's up to people to draw their own lines and decide their own attitudes to these things. And if there's a groundswell of opinion, and it may well be that in 10 years' time we'll look back and think, hang on a minute, that was, you know, that really does look out of step with the way the world has gone. But at the moment, you know, it is a matter for debate, and people have different opinions on it.
One area where I have a bit of sympathy, and this was a mood that I picked up at the Tour of Yorkshire, was a lot of the other teams and riders had a lot of sympathy for the riders on what is now Team Ineos, because it's not like they have signed for Team Ineos. The team has become Team Ineos mid-season, and people expecting riders to, you know, take some kind of principled stand on that, or, you know, walk away, that's not going to happen. And I would argue that very few people, if, you know, they found that their, you know, their employer changed to somebody who's ethics or practice they didn't approve of, very few people would be in a position to do anything about that. So, you know, I think it's completely understandable that the protesters would focus their ire on the riders and boo them and you know, expose them in that way.
But this is what always happens, isn't it?
Of course, of course.
The people who have the least power to change things, really, are the ones that attract the antagonism.
And in the grand scheme of things, I mean, I think the protesters, they, you know, draw attention to a really important issue, and their numbers will only swell, I think, over future years. We can all sense that the mood is changing, the climate is changing, no pun intended, but the things are changing, and I think the numbers of people who will be protesting will increase. And if, you know, sport becomes a stage for them as well, good, really. Next question.
Last question, I think, is from Sam in London.
Hi, guys. This is Sam from London. Long time listening to the show, even when I was living in South Africa for a number of years. So think what you guys do is awesome. I had an interesting question about when you're at the Grand Tours and you get lots of great audio from the riders. Every day you seem to speak to lots of interesting people. And as you've mentioned before, you know, you have developed great relationships with loads of people within the tour. My question is, on a daily basis, when you, let's say the stage is done and you head over to the finish line, how do you approach them? I mean, how does that work in real time? obviously, if I was one of the riders or a sports director and a reporter, even if I know them, comes up to me and shoves a microphone in my face, that's a bit threatening. It's a bit annoying. So my question was, what's your chat up line, should we say? And how do you get in? I mean, do you, for example, just have a quick chat, no microphones, catch up, small talk, or do you go in straight with the questions? Would love to know. Again, good luck for the Giro. Really looking forward to your coverage. All the best. Bye.
So Lionel, what's your favourite chat up line? How do you work your magic?
Well, I sort of hang back a bit and see what my chances of success will be.
Wait till 3 o'clock, chucking out time.
No, it's awkward though, isn't it? It's a very awkward way to earn a living, isn't it? Somebody cycled 200 kilometres and there you are with your microphone. Hello, can I ask you about cycling 200 kilometres?
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, it was a funny listening to the question, and because it's something that you take for granted to such an extent, and so do the riders, that it's a completely normal thing to walk up to a rider who's just ridden 200 kilometres and shove your recorder in his face. They expect it, and you know, there's nothing strange about it.
No, there's kind of in the finish straight, there's almost zones, isn't there? There's the zone A, which is where the people who've done something in the stage get mobbed by TV and radio. And as a podcast or print journalist, you can kind of get your arm under with your recorder and kind of record other people's interviews. Sometimes you might get a question in at the end as TV have wrapped up. Daniel, you know, you take precedence when you've got your cameraman by your side. Yeah, right. There's a hierarchy though, isn't there? Yeah. I'm not being flippant about it.
Occasionally throw you some crumbs, don't I?
You do, yeah, you do, yeah. Yeah. No, a bit of eye, you know, a bit of eyebrows and a nudge. You answer that guy's question, take pity on
it. But there's also, you know, you can wait on the finishing straight and get riders then who've just literally crossed the line and finished. Or you can go back to the buses and wait for the riders who either get them before they get on the bus or after they come off the bus. I would say that we, as a podcast, we don't generally try and get the day's winner, the yellow jersey, or the big stars. We get other riders who perhaps a lot of other journalists are not going to, because A, they're easier to get to, and B, they've often got a different take on what's happened that day.
Yeah, that's the middle zone is the one where often riders have stopped to get a drink from their soigneur or before, you know, and directions back to their buses. And sometimes you can get some pretty good stuff there. And like you say, if the finish line and the buses are close together, you can do both, can't you? You can go to the finish line and then go back to the bus and get people as they come in. The mountain stages are always quite good because you get three or four bites of the cherry. You get the first group come over and then you get the sort of the domestiques and you get a different perspective from them. And then you might get even some guys from the Gruppetto.
You can tell them what happened.
Yeah.
But I think in the sort of panorama of sports journalism, sports coverage, it's an almost unique smash and grab arrangement, and the logistics of it are pretty unique, I would suggest, among other sports. You know, the fact that sometimes he's talking to a guy who stops after the finish, and then, you know, 2 minutes later you'll be talking to someone else 500 meters away at his bus, and really nothing is really laid on a plate. It's guerrilla journalism after the finish.
I mean, they do have a mix zone, don't they, where you know, the stage winner, the jersey
for TV and radio.
For TV and radio, but we can go in there as well. We're just further down the pecking order, and sometimes
but
the riders
really uses
we
that,
never
we
never do though. No. We never do.
No, I sometimes hang around in there just to see what's what.
That's not where you go.
Yeah, go and see.
Where's Lionel?
Pick up a few crumbs.
Daniel, you seen Lionel? Is he off at the buffet again? No, but it's you know, and there are riders that you get to know, obviously, and they know kind of exactly what you want. But there are always other riders who, you know, they don't know who you are, and so they don't really know who they're talking to or what you want them to say. And you still get, you know, awkward exchanges. Casper Asgreen at the Paris-Roubaix, I had a pretty awkward exchange with him. He didn't actually really know what, he didn't know Gilbert, his teammate, had won, and you know, he was sort of catching up, and I probably just misjudged it. I probably just mistimed it. If I'd let him gather his thoughts a bit more, he'd have been more willing to share some of his thoughts, but he was quite evasive, so you didn't hear that interview, the podcast, obviously.
The size of your microphone or your equipment often dictates how willing people are to talk. If you can hire someone like a body double, a sort of fake Patsy cameraman, that always helps.
Yeah, I think there's an element.
Interview doping.
That's very true. When after a stage, always feel quite awkward to be maybe working on an episode of Kilometre Zero where you want to ask questions about something not relating to the stage. And that feels always, I find that hard after a stage. Whereas in the morning, you can go off diary a bit more and say, oh, I'm making a thing about this.
What do you remember about the 1994 Giro?
Yeah, after the finish, that often doesn't work too well because the riders are just coming out of their race zone and they're...
But you always get the journalists with their own agendas in press conferences as well. Try working for a Scottish newspaper at an international sports event. You know, the desire or the requirement to stick a kilt on it means that you end up having to ask Novak Djokovic about his mini break in Scotland.
You're going to be quids in, though, at the Giro with Teo Gegenhart, Scottish rider, taking part.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Get loads in there. What's your favourite shortbread, Teo?
Domenico Pozzovivo did one semester at Stirling University. Did you know that?
No, it was Dario Cioni.
No, I'm joking. I was trying to wind you up. I was trying to send you off on a goose chase.
I got a big spread in the Scotsman on Dario Cioni's term at Strathclyde University a few years ago. So yeah, it's amazing what you can do. But yeah, I mean, it's you don't really, I suppose, think about it too much now, but. It is strange the way it's set up, and you still do, even after a few years of doing it, have the odd awkward encounter. So that's really got us in the mood for heading off to the Giro. Yeah. Actually, we spoke about the Giro over lunch, didn't we? And we were talking about plans for Kilometre Zero and, you know, what we were going to do, how we were going to try and keep the episodes
sharp
and on point and, you know. And it got me quite excited about the race, I must say, and about our daily coverage.
It's going to be good.
Are you excited, Daniel?
Oh, this is your home grand tour, Daniel. If you're not excited for this
one,
then...
You love this, can't Daniel.
Produce
come on.
Excitement on tap.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, on that note, I think the press office is doing the famous wind it up symbol, hand symbol.
Gone on. I mean, so much for our, you know... lunchtime discussion about keeping episodes sharp and anyway, we'll do that at the Giro. Thanks for listening in the meantime, and thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Happy
see you in Bologna.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Kotze,